Welcome back to my relaxing literature podcast. Tonight we're continuing our reading of The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett. I noticed on my last reading of Frankenstein that my voice sounded a little bit squeaky again, so I have a cup of tea with lemon and honey, and hopefully we'll be able to read this without my voice sounding squeaky and annoying. We are currently beginning chapter 23, which is titled Magic. If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider supporting to help me improve the quality. And please follow me on Instagram at Relaxing Literature. Chapter 23, Magic. Dr. Craven had been waiting some time at the house when they returned to it. He had indeed begun to wonder if it might not be wise to send someone out to explore the garden paths. When Colin was brought back to his room, the poor man looked him over seriously. "You should not have stayed so long," he said. "You must not overexert yourself." "I am not tired at all," said Colin. "It has made me well. Tomorrow I am going out in the morning, as well as in the afternoon." "I'm not sure that I can allow it," answered Dr. Craven. "I am afraid it would not be wise." "It would not be wise to try to stop me," said Colin quite seriously. "I am going." Even Mary had found out that one of Colin's chief peculiarities was that he did not know in the least what a rude little brute he was with his way of ordering people about. He had lived on a sort of desert island all his life, and as he had been the king of it, he made his own manners and had no one to compare himself with. Mary had indeed been rather like him herself, and since she had been a Misselthwaite had gradually discovered that her own manners had not been the kind which is usual or proper. Having made this discovery, she naturally thought of it enough. Having made this discovery, she naturally thought it of enough interest to communicate it to Colin. So she sat and looked at him curiously for a few minutes after Dr. Craven had gone. She wanted to make him ask her why she was doing it, and of course she did. "What are you looking at me for?" he said. "I'm thinking that I'm rather sorry for Dr. Craven." "So am I," said Colin calmly, but not without an air of some satisfaction. "He won't get Misselthwaite at all now that I'm not going to die." "I'm sorry for him because of that, of course," said Mary. "But I was thinking that it must have been very horrid to have been polite for 10 years to a boy who was always rude. I would have never done it." "I'm sorry for him because of that, of course," said Mary. "But I was thinking just then that it must have been very horrid to have had to be polite for 10 years to a boy who was always rude. I would never have done it." "Am I rude?" Colin inquired undisturbedly. "If you had been his own boy, and he had been a slapping sort of man," said Mary, "he would have slapped you." "But he daren't," said Colin. "No, he daren't," answered Mistress Mary, thinking the thing quite without prejudice. "Nobody ever dared to do anything you didn't like, because you were going to die and things like that. You were such a poor thing." "But," announced Colin stubbornly, "I am not going to be a poor thing. I won't let people think I'm one. I stood on my own feet this afternoon." "It is always having your own way that has made you so queer," Mary went on, thinking aloud. Colin turned his head, frowning. "Am I queer?" he demanded. "Yes," answered Mary, "very." "But you needn't be cross," she said impartially, "because so am I queer. and so is Ben Weatherstaff. But I am not as queer as I was before I began to like people, and before I found the garden. I don't want to be queer, said Colin. I am not going to be. And he frowned again with determination. He was a very proud boy. He lay thinking for a while, and then Mary saw his beautiful smile begin and gradually change his whole face. I shall stop being queer, he said. If I go every day to the garden, there is magic in there. Good magic, you know, Mary. I am sure there is. So am I, said Mary. Even if it isn't magic. Even if it isn't real magic, Colin said, we can pretend it is. Something is there. Something. It's magic, said Mary, but not black. It's as white as snow. They always called it magic, and indeed it seemed like it in the months that followed. The wonderful months, the radiant months, the amazing ones. Oh, the things which happened in that garden. If you have never had a garden, you cannot understand. And if you have had a garden, you will know that it would take a whole book to describe all the things that came to pass there. At first it seemed that green things would never cease pushing their way through the earth, in the grass, in the beds, even in the crevices of the walls. Then the green things began to show buds, and the buds began to unfurl and show color, every shade of blue, every shade of purple, every tint and hue of crimson. In its happy days, flowers had been tucked away into every inch and hole and corner. Ben Weatherstaff had seen it done, and had himself scraped out mortar from between the bricks of the wall, and made pockets of earth for lovely clinging things to grow on. Iris and white lilies rose out of the grass in sheaves, and the green alcoves filled themselves with amazing armies of blue and white flower lances, of tall delphiniums and columbines and campanulas. Iris and white lilies rose out of the grass in sheaves, and the green alcoves filled themselves with amazing armies of blue and white flower lances, of tall delphiniums or columbines or campanulas. She was main fond of them, she was, Ben Weatherstaff said. She liked them things, as was Alice pointing up to the blue sky, she used to tell. Not as she was one of them looked down at the earth, not her. She just loved it, but she said as the blue sky Alice looked so joyful. The seeds Dickon and Mary had planted grew as if fairies had tended to them. Satiny poppies of all tints danced in the breeze by the score, gaily defying flowers which had lived in the garden for years, and which might be confessed, seemed rather to wonder how such new people had got there. And the roses, rising out of the grass, tangled round the sundial, wreathing the tree trunks and hanging from their branches, climbing up the walls and spreading over them with long garlands falling in cascades, they came alive day by day, hour by hour, fresh fair leaves and buds. Buds, tiny at first but swelling and working magic until they burst and uncurled into cups of scent, delicately spilling themselves over their brims and filling the garden air. Colin saw it all, watching each change as it took place. Every morning he was brought out, and every hour of each day, when it didn't rain, he spent in the garden. Even gray days pleased him. He would lie on the grass, watching things growing, he said. If you watched long enough, he declared, you could see the buds unsheath themselves. Also, you could make the acquaintance of several busy insect things running about on various unknown but evidently serious errands, sometimes carrying tiny scraps of straw or feather or food, or climbing blades of grass as if they were trees from whose tops one could look out to explore the country. A mole throwing up its mound at the end of its burrow and making its way out at last with the long-nailed paws, which looked so like elfish hands, had absorbed him one whole morning. Ants' ways, beetles' ways, bees' ways, frogs' ways, birds' ways, plants' ways, gave him a whole new world to explore, and when Dickon revealed them all and added foxes' ways, otters' ways, ferrets' ways, squirrels' ways, and trouts, and water rats, and bats' Badger's ways, there was no end to the things to talk about and to think over. And this was not half of the magic. The fact that he really had once stood on his feet set Colin thinking tremendously, and when Mary told him of the spell she had worked, he was excited and approved of it greatly. He talked of it constantly. "Of course, there must be lots of magic in the world," he said wisely one day, "but people don't know what it's like or how to make it. Perhaps the beginning is just to say nice things are going to happen until you make them happen. I am going to try and experiment." The next morning, when they came... The next morning, when they went to the secret garden, he sent at once for Ben Weatherstaff. Ben came as quickly as he could and found the Rajah standing on his feet under a tree and looking very grand, but also very beautifully smiling. "Good morning, Ben Weatherstaff," he said. "I want you and Dickon and Miss Mary to stand in a row and listen to me, because I am going to tell you something very important." "Aye, aye, sir," answered Ben Weatherstaff, touching his forehead. One of the long-concealed charms of Ben Weatherstaff was that his boyhood had once... One of the long-concealed charms of Ben Weatherstaff was that in his boyhood he had once run away to sea and had made voyages, so he could reply like a sailor. "I am going to try a scientific experiment," explained the Rajah. "When I grow up, I am going to make great scientific discoveries, and I am going to begin now with this experiment." "Aye, aye, sir," said Ben Weatherstaff promptly, though this was the first time he had heard of great scientific discoveries. It was the first time Mary had heard of them either, but even at this stage she had begun to realize that, queer as he was, Colin had read about a great many singular things and was somehow a very convincing sort of boy. When he held up his head and fixed his strange eyes on you, it seemed as if you believed him almost in spite of yourself, though he was only 10 years old, going on 11. At this moment, he was especially convincing because he suddenly felt the fascination of actually making a sort of speech like a grown-up person. "The great scientific discoveries I am going to make," he went on, "will be about magic. Magic is a great thing, and scarcely anyone knows anything about it, except a few people in old books, and Mary a little, because she was born in India, where there are fakirs. I believe Dickon knows some magic, but perhaps he doesn't know he knows it. He charms animals and people. I would never have let him come to see me if he had not been an animal charmer, which is a boy charmer too, because a boy is an animal. I am sure there is magic in everything, only we have not sense enough to get hold of it and make it do things for us, like electricity and horses and steam." This sounded so imposing that Ben Weatherstaff became quite excited and really could not keep still. "Aye, aye, sir," he said, and began to stand up quite straight. "When Mary found this garden, it looked quite dead," the orator proceeded. "Then something began pushing things up out of the soil and making things out of nothing. One day things weren't there, and another they were. I have never watched things before, and it made me feel very curious. Scientific people are always curious, and I am going to be scientific. I keep saying to myself, 'What is it? What is it?' It's something. It can't be nothing. I don't know its name, so I call it magic. I have never seen the sun rise. I have never seen the sun rise, but Mary and Dickon have, and from what they tell me, I am sure that it is magic too. Something pushes it up and draws it. Something since I've been in the garden, I've looked up. Sometimes since I've been in the garden, I've looked up through the trees at the sky, and I've had a strange feeling of being happy, as if something were pushing and drawing in my chest and making me breathe fast. Magic is always pushing and drawing and making things out of nothing. Everything is made out of magic, leaves and trees, flowers and birds, badges. Everything is made out of magic, Leaves and trees, flowers and birds, badgers and foxes and squirrels and people. So it must be all around us, in this garden, in all the places. The magic in this garden has made me stand up and know I'm going to live to be a man. I'm going to make the scientific experiment of trying to get some and put it in myself and make it push and draw me and make me strong. I don't know how to do it, but I think that if you keep thinking about it and calling it, perhaps it will come. Perhaps that is the first baby way to get it. When I was going to stand for the first time, Mary kept saying to herself as fast as she could, "You can do it, you can do it." And I did. I had to try myself at the same time, of course, but her magic helped me, and so did Dickens. Every morning and evening, and as often in the daytime as I can remember, I am going to say, "Magic is in me. Magic is making me well. I'm going to be as strong as Dickens, as strong as Dickens." And you must all do it too. That is my experiment. Will you help, Ben Weatherstaff?" "Aye, aye, sir," said Ben Weatherstaff. "Aye, sir." "Aye, aye, sir," said Ben Weatherstaff. "Aye, aye." "If you keep doing it every day, as regularly as soldiers go through drill, we shall see what will happen and find out if the experiment succeeds. You learn things by saying them over and over and thinking about them until they stay in your mind forever, and I think it will be the same with magic. If you keep calling it to come to you and help you, it will get to be a part of you, and it will stay and do things." I once heard an officer in India tell my mother that there were fakirs who said words over and over thousands of times, said Mary. I've heard Jem Fettleworth's wife say the same thing over thousands of times, calling Jem a drunken brute, said Ben Weatherstaff dryly. Summit always comes to that, sure enough. He gave her a good hiding, and went off to the Blue Lion and got drunk as a lord. Colin drew his brows together and thought a few minutes. Then he cheered up. "Well," he said, "you see, something did come of it. She used the wrong magic until she made him beat her. If she'd used the right magic and had it said something nice, perhaps he wouldn't have gotten as drunk as a lord, and perhaps he might have bought her a new bonnet." Ben Weatherstaff chuckled, and there was a shrewd admiration in his little old eyes. "Thou'rt a clever lad as well as a straight-legged one, Mr. Colin," he said. "Next time I see Beth Fettleworth, I'll give her a hint of what magic will do for her. She'd be rare and pleased if the scientific experiment worked, and so would Jem." Dickon had stood listening to the lecture, his round eyes shining with curious delight. Nut and Shell were on his shoulders, and he held a long-eared white rabbit in his arm and stroked it softly while it laid its ears along its back and enjoyed itself. "Do you think the experiment will work?" Colin asked him, wondering what he was thinking. He so often wondered what Dickon was thinking when he saw him looking at him or at one of his creatures with his happy, wide smile. He smiled now, and his smile was wider than usual. "Aye," he answered, "that I do. It'll work same as the seeds do when the sun shines on 'em. It'll work for sure. Shall us begin it now?" Colin was delighted, and so was Mary. Fired by recollections of fakirs and devotees in illustrations, Colin suggested that they should all sit cross-legged under the tree which made a canopy. "It will be like sitting in a sort of temple," said Colin. "I'm rather tired, and I want to sit down." "Eh," said Dickon, "thou mustn't begin by saying thou art tired. It might spoil the magic." Colin turned and looked at him into his innocent round eyes. "That's true," he said slowly. "I must only think of the magic." It all seemed most majestic and mysterious when they sat down in their circle. Ben Weatherstaff felt as if he had somehow been led into appearing at a prayer meeting. Ordinarily, he was fixed in being what he called, again, prayer meetings, but this being the Rajah's affair, he did not resent it, and was indeed inclined to be gratified at being called upon to assist. Mistress Mary felt solemnly enraptured. Dickon held his rabbit in his arm, and perhaps he made some charmer's signal no one heard, for when he sat down, cross-legged like the rest, the crow, the fox, the squirrels, and the lamb slowly drew near and made part of the circle, settling into each. Dickon held his rabbit in his arm, and perhaps he made some charm or signal no one heard, for when he sat down, cross-legged like the rest, the crow, the fox, the squirrels, and the lamb slowly drew near and made part of the circle, settling each into a place of rest as if it had been their own desire. "The creatures have come," said Colin gravely. "They want to help us." Colin really looked quite beautiful, Mary thought. He held his head high, as if he felt like a sort of priest, and his strange eyes had a wonderful look in them. The light shone on him through a tree canopy. "Now we will begin," he said. "Shall we sway backward and forward, Mary, as if we were dervishes?" "I cannot do no swaying backward and forward," said Ben Weatherstaff. "I've got the rheumatics." "The magic will take them away," said Colin in a high priest tone. "But we won't sway until it has done it. We will only chant." "I cannot do no chanting," said Ben Weatherstaff a trifle testily. "They turned me out of the church choir the only time I ever tried it." No one smiled. They were all too much in earnest. Colin's face was not even crossed by a shadow. He was thinking only of the magic. "Then I will chant," he said, and he began, looking like a strange boy spirit. "The sun is shining, the sun is shining. That is the magic. The flowers are growing, the roots are stirring. That is the magic. Being alive is the magic. Being strong is the magic. The magic is in me. The magic is in me. It is in me. It is in me. It's in every one of us. It's in Ben Weatherstaff's back. Magic. Magic. Come and help." He said it a great many times, not a thousand times, but quite a goodly number. Mary listened, entranced. She felt as if it were at once queer and beautiful, and she wanted him to go on and on. Ben Weatherstaff began to feel soothed into a sort of dream which was quite agreeable. The humming of the bees in the blossoms mingled with the chanting voice and drowsily melted into a doze. Dickon sat cross-legged with his rabbit asleep on his arm and a hand resting on the lamb's back. Soot had pushed away a squirrel and huddled close to him on his shoulder. The gray film dropped over his eyes. At last, Colin stopped. "Now I'm going to walk round the garden," he announced. Ben Weatherstaff's head had just dropped forward, and he lifted it with a jerk. "You have been asleep," said Colin. "Not of the sort," mumbled Ben. "Not of the sort," mumbled Ben. "The sermon was good enough, but I'm bound to get out afore the collection." He was not quite awake yet. "You're not in church," said Colin. "Not me," said Ben, straightening himself. "Who said I were? I heard every bit of it. You said the magic was in my back. The doctor calls it rheumatics." The Rajah waved his hand. "That was the wrong magic," he said. "You will get better. You have my permission to go to your work, but come back tomorrow." "I'd like to see thee walk round the garden," grunted Ben. It was not an unfriendly grunt, but it was a grunt. In fact, being a stubborn old party and not having entire faith in magic, he had made up his mind that if he were sent away, he would climb his ladder and look over the wall so that he might be ready to hobble back if there were any stumbling. The Rajah did not object to his staying. "I'd like to see thee walk round the garden," grunted Ben. It was not an unfriendly grunt, but it was a grunt. In fact, being a stubborn old party, and not having entire faith in magic, he had made up his mind that if he were sent away, he would climb his ladder and look over the wall so that he might be ready to hobble back if there were any stumbling. The Rajah did not object to his staying, and so the procession was formed. It really did look like a procession. Colin was at its head with Dickon on one side and Mary on the other. Ben Weatherstaff walked behind, and the creatures trailed after them. The lamb and the fox cub keeping close to Dickon, the white rabbit hopping along or stopping to nibble, and Soot following with the solemnity of a person who felt himself in charge. It was a procession which moved slowly, but with dignity. Every few yards it stopped to rest. Colin leaned on Dickon's arm, and privately Ben Weatherstaff kept a sharp lookout, but now and then Colin took his hand from its support and walked a few steps alone. His head was held up all the time, and he looked very grand. "The magic is in me," he kept saying. "The magic is making me strong. I can feel it. I can feel it." It seemed very certain that something was upholding and uplifting him. He sat on the seats in the alcoves, and once or twice he sat down on the grass, and several times he paused in the path and leaned on Dickon, but he would not give up until he had gone all round the garden. When he returned to the canopy tree, his cheeks were flushed, and he looked triumphant. "I did it. The magic worked," he cried out. "That is my first scientific discovery." "What will Dr. Craven say?" broke out Mary. "He won't say anything," Colin answered, "because he will not be told. This is to be the biggest secret of all. No one is to know anything about it until I have grown so strong that I can walk and run like any other boy. I shall come here every day in my chair, and I shall be taken back in it. I won't have people whispering and asking questions, and I won't let my father hear about it until the experiment has quite succeeded. Then, sometime when he comes back to Misselthwaite, I shall just walk into his study and say, 'Here I am. I am like any other boy. I am quite well, and I shall live to be a man. It has been done by a scientific experiment.'" "He will think he is in a dream," cried Mary. "He won't believe his eyes." Colin flushed triumphantly. He had made himself believe that he was going to get well, which was really more than half the battle, if he had been aware of it. And the thought which stimulated him more than any other was this imagining what his father would look like when he saw that he had a son who was as straight and strong as other father's sons. One of his darkest miseries in the unhealthy, morbid past days, had been his hatred of being a sickly, weak-backed boy whose father was afraid to look at him. "He'll be obliged to believe them," he said. "One of the things I am going to do, after the magic works and before I begin to make scientific discoveries, is to be an athlete." "We shall have thee taken to boxing in a week or so," said Ben Weatherstaff. "Thou'lt end with winning the belt and being champion prize fighter of all England." Colin fixed his eyes on him sternly. "Weatherstaff," he said, "that is disrespectful. You must not take liberties because you are in on the secret. However much the magic works, I shall not be a prize fighter. I shall be a scientific discoverer."
Ax pardon, sir," answered Ben, touching his forehead in salute. "I ought to have seen it wasn't a joking manner.
But his eyes twinkled, and secretly he was immensely pleased. He really did not mind being snubbed, since the snubbing meant that the lad was gaining strength and spirit. Chapter 24. Let Them Laugh. The secret garden was not the only one Dickon worked in. Round the cottage on the moor, there was a piece of ground enclosed by a low wall of rough stones. Early in the morning and late in the fading twilight, and on all the days Colin and Mary did not see him, Dickon worked there, planting or tending potatoes and cabbages, turnips and carrots and herbs for his mother. In the company of his creatures, he did wonders there, and was never tired of doing them, it seemed. While he dug or weeded, he whistled or sang bits of Yorkshire moor songs, or talked to Soot or Captain, or the brothers and sisters he had taught to help him. We'd never get as comfortable as we do, Mrs. Sowerby said, if it wasn't for Dickon's garden.
Anything will grow for him. His taters and cabbages is twice the size of anyone else's, and they've got a flavor with them as nobody has. When she found a moment to spare, she liked to go out and talk to him. After supper, she was still a long, clear twilight. After supper, there was still a long, clear twilight to work in, and that was her quiet time. She could sit upon the low, rough wall and look on and hear stories of the day. She loved this time. There were not only vegetables in this garden. Dickon had bought penny packages of flower seeds now and then, and sown bright, sweet-scented things among gooseberry bushes, and even cabbages, and he grew borders of mignonette and pinks and pansies, and things whose seeds he could save year after year, or whose roots would bloom each spring and spread in time into fine clumps. The low wall was one of the prettiest things in Yorkshire, because he had tucked moorland foxglove and ferns and rock cress and hedgerow flowers into every crevice until only here and there glimpses. The low wall was one of the prettiest things in Yorkshire, because he had tucked moorland foxglove and ferns and rock cress and hedgerow flowers into every crevice until only here and there glimpses of the stones were to be seen. "All a chap's got to do to make 'em thrive, mother," he would say, "is to be friends with 'em for sure. They're just like the creatures. If they're thirsty, give 'em a drink, and if they're hungry, give 'em a bit of food. They want to live same as we do. If they died, I should feel as if I'd been a bad lad and somehow treated them heartless." It was in these twilight hours that Mrs. Sowerby heard all of that happened. It was in these twilight hours that Mrs. Sowerby heard all that happened in the Misselthwaite Manor. At first, she was only told that Mr. Colin had taken a fancy to going out into the grounds with Miss Mary, and that it was doing him some good. But it was not long before it was agreed between the two children that Dickon's mother might come into the secret. Somehow, it was not doubted that she was safe for sure. So one beautiful, still evening, Dickon told the whole story, with all the thrilling details of the buried key and the robin and the grey haze which had seemed like deadness and the secret Mistress Mary had planned never to reveal. The coming of Dickon and how it had been told to him, the doubt of Mr. Colin and the final drama of his introduction to the hidden domain, combined with the incident of Ben Weatherstaff's angry face peering over the wall and Mr. Collins's sudden indignant strength, made Mrs. Sowerby's nice-looking face quite change color several times. "My word," she said, "it was a good thing that little lass came to the manor. It's been making her..." "My word," she said, "it was a good thing that little lass came to the manor. It's been the making of her and the saving of him, standing on his feet, and all us thinking he was a poor half-witted lad with not a straight bone in him." She asked a great many questions, and her blue eyes were full of deep thinking. "What do they make of it at the manor, him being well and cheerful and never complaining?" she inquired. "They don't know what to make of it," answered Dickon. "Every day as comes round, his face looks different. It's filling out, and it doesn't look so sharp, and the waxy color is going. But he has to do his bit of complaining," with a highly entertained grin. "What for, in mercy's name?" asked Mrs. Sowerby. Dickon chuckled. "He does it to keep him from guessing what's happened. If the doctor knew he'd found out he could stand on his feet, he'd likely write and tell Mr. Craven. Mr. Craven's saving the secret to tell himself. He's going to practice his magic on his legs every day till his father comes back, and then he's going to march into his room and show him he's straight as other lads. But him and Miss Mary thinks it's the best plan to do a bit of groaning and fretting now and then to throw folks off the scent." Mrs. Sowerby was laughing a low, comfortable laugh. Mrs. Sowerby was laughing a low, comfortable laugh long before he had finished his last sentence. "Eh," she said, "that pair's enjoying themselves, I'll warrant." "They'll get a good bit of play-actin' out of it, and there's nothing children likes as much as play-actin'. Let's hear what they do, Dickon, lad." Dickon stopped waiting and sat up on his heels to tell her. His eyes were twinkling with fun. "Mr. Colin is carried down to his chair every time he goes out," he explained, "and he flies out at John, the footman, for not carrying him careful enough. He makes himself as helpless looking as he can and never lifts his head until we're out of sight of the house. And he grunts and frets a good bit when he's being settled into his chair. Him and Miss Mary both got to enjoying it, and when he groans and complains, she'll say, 'Poor Colin, does it hurt you so much? Are you so weak as that, poor Colin?' But the trouble is that sometimes they can scarce keep from bursting out laughing. When we get safe into the garden, they laugh till they've no breath left to laugh with, and they have to stuff their faces into Mr. Collins' cushions to keep the gardeners from hearing if any of them's about." "The more they laugh, the better for 'em," said Mrs. Sowerby, laughing herself. "Good, healthy child laughing's better than pills any day of the year. That pair'll plump up for sure." "They are plumping up," said Dickon. "They're that hungry they don't know how to get enough to eat without making talk. Mr. Collins says if he keeps sending for more food, they won't believe he's an invalid at all. Miss Mary says she'll let him eat her share, but he says if she goes hungry, she'll get as thin. And they mun both get fat at once." Mrs. Sowerby laughed so heartily at the revelation of this difficulty that she quite rocked backward and forward in her blue cloak, and Dickon laughed with her. "I'll tell thee what, lad," said Mrs. Sowerby when she could speak. "I've thought of a way to help 'em. When thou goes to 'em in the morning, thou shalt take a pail o' new milk, and I'll bake 'em a crusty cottage loaf or some buns with currants in 'em, same as you children like. Nothing so good as fresh milk and bread. Then they could take the edge off their hunger while they're in the garden, and the fine food they get indoors would polish off their corners." "Eh, mother," said Dickon admiringly. "What a wonder thou art. Thou always sees a way out of things. They was quite in a ponder yesterday. Eh, mother," said Dickon admiringly, "what a wonder thou art. Thou always sees a way out of things. They was quite in a pother yesterday. They didn't see how they was to manage without ordering up more food. They felt that empty inside. They're two young'uns growing fast, and health's coming back to both of 'em. Children like that feels like young wolves, and food's flesh and blood to 'em," said Mrs. Sowerby. Then she smiled, Dickon's own curving smile. "Eh, but they're enjoying themselves for sure," she said. She was quite right, the comfortable, wonderful mother creature, and she had never been more so than when she said their play-actin' would be their joy. Colin and Mary found it one of their most thrilling sources of entertainment. The idea of protecting themselves from suspicion had been unconsciously suggested to them, first by the puzzled nurse, and then by Dr. Craven himself. "Your appetite is improving very much, Mr. Craven," the nurse had said one day. "You used to eat nothing, and so many things disagreed with you." "Nothing disagrees with me now," replied Colin, and then seeing the nurse looking at him curiously, he suddenly remembered that perhaps he ought not to appear too well just yet. "At least, things don't so often disagree with me. It's the fresh air." "Perhaps it is," said the nurse, still looking at him with a mystified expression. "But I must talk to Dr. Craven about it." "How she stared at you," said Mary when she went away, "as if she thought there must be something to find out." "I won't have her finding out things," said Colin. No one must begin to find out yet. When Dr. Craven came that morning, he seemed puzzled also. He asked a number of questions, to Colin's great annoyance. "You stay out in the garden a great deal," he suggested. "Where do you go?" Colin put on his favorite air of dignified indifference to opinion. "I will not let anyone know where I go," he answered. "I go to a place I like. Everyone has orders to keep out of the way. I won't be watched and stared at. You know that." "You seem to be out all day, but I do not think it has done you harm." "I do not think so. The nurse says that you eat much more than you have ever done before." "Perhaps," said Colin, prompted by a sudden inspiration, "perhaps it is an unnatural appetite." "I do not think so, as your food seems to agree with you," said Dr. Craven. "You are gaining flesh rapidly, and your color is better." Perhaps I am bloated and feverish," said Colin, assuming a discouraging air of gloom. "Perhaps I am bloated and feverish," said Colin, assuming a discouraging air of gloom. "People who are not going to live are often different." Dr. Craven shook his head. He was holding Colin's wrist, and he pushed up his sleeve and felt his arm. "You are not feverish," he said thoughtfully, "and such flesh as you have gained is healthy. If you can keep this up, my boy, we need not talk of dying. Your father will be very happy to hear of this remarkable improvement." "I won't have him told," Colin broke forth fiercely. "It will only disappoint him if I get worse again. And I make it worse this very night. I might have a raging fever. I feel as if I might be beginning to have one now. I won't have letters written to my father. I won't. I won't. You are making me angry, and you know that is bad for me. I feel hot already. I hate being written about and talked over as much as I hate being stared at." "Hush, my boy," Dr. Craven soothed him. "Nothing shall be written without your permission. You are too sensitive about things. You must not undo the good which has been done." He said no more about writing to Mr. Craven, and when he saw the nurse, he privately warned her that such a possibility must not be mentioned to the patient. "The boy is extraordinarily better," he said. "His advance seems almost abnormal. But, of course, he is doing now of his own free will what we could not make him do before. Still, he excites himself very easily, and nothing must be said to irritate him." Mary and Colin were much alarmed and talked together anxiously. From this time dated their plan of play-acting. "I may be obliged to have a tantrum," said Colin regretfully. "I don't want to have one, and I'm not miserable enough now to work myself into a big one. Perhaps I couldn't have one at all. That lump doesn't come in my throat now, and I keep thinking of nice things instead of horrible ones. But if they talk about writing to my father, I shall have to do something." He made up his mind to eat less, but unfortunately it was not possible to carry out this brilliant idea when he wakened each morning with an amazing appetite, and the table near his sofa was set with a breakfast of homemade bread and fresh butter, snow-white eggs, raspberry jam, and clotted cream. Mary always breakfasted with him, and when they found themselves at the table, particularly if there were delicate slices of sizzling ham sending forth tempting odors from under hot silver cover, they would look into each other's eyes in desperation. "I think we shall have to eat it all this morning, Mary," Colin always ended by saying. "We can send some away of the lunch and a great deal of the dinner." But they never found they could send anything, and the highly polished condition of the empty plates returned to the pantry awakened much comment. "I do wish," Colin would also say, "I do wish the slices of ham were thicker, and one muffin each is not enough for anyone." "It is enough for a person who is going to die," answered Mary when first she heard this. "But it's not enough for a person who's going to live. I sometimes feel as if I could eat three, and when those nice fresh heather and gorse smells from the moor come pouring in the open window, The morning that Dickon after they had been enjoying themselves in the garden for about 2 hours, went behind a big rose bush and brought forth 2 tin pails and revealed that one held cottage-made currant buns folded in a clean blue and white napkin, buns so carefully tucked in that they were still hot. There was a riot of surprised joyfulness. What a wonderful thing for Mrs. Sowerby to think of. What a kind, clever woman she must be. How good the buns were, and what delicious fresh milk. The morning that Dickon, after they had been enjoying themselves in the garden for about 2 hours, went behind a big rose bush and brought forth 2 tin pails, and revealed that one was full of rich new milk with cream on top of it, and that the other had cottage-made currant buns folded in a clean blue and white napkin, buns so carefully tucked in that they were still hot. There was a riot of surprised joyfulness. What a wonderful thing for Mrs. Sowerby to think of. What a kind, clever woman she must be. How good the buns were, and what delicious fresh milk. Magic is in her just as it is in Dickon, said Colin. It makes her think of ways to do things, nice things. She is a magic person. Tell her we are grateful, Dickon, extremely grateful. He was given to using rather grown-up phrases at times. He enjoyed them. He liked this so much that he improved upon it. Tell her she has been most bounteous and our gratitude is extreme. And then, forgetting his grandeur, he fell to and stuffed himself with buns and drank milk out of the pail in copious draughts in the manner of any hungry little boy who had been taking unusual exercise and breathing in moorland air and whose breakfast was more than 2 hours behind him. This was the beginning of many agreeable incidents of the same kind. They actually awoke to the fact that as Mrs. Sowerby had 14 people to provide food for, she might not have enough to satisfy 2 extra appetites every day, so they asked her to let them send some of their shillings to buy things. Dickon made the stimulating discovery that in the wood in the park outside the garden, where Mary had first found him piping to the wild creatures, there was a deep little hollow where you could build a sort of tiny oven with stones and roast potatoes and eggs in it. Roasted eggs were a previously unknown luxury, and very hot potatoes with salt and fresh butter in them were fit for a woodland king, besides being deliciously satisfying. You could buy both potatoes and eggs and eat as many as you liked without feeling as if you were taking food out of the mouths of 14 people. Every beautiful morning, the magic was worked by the mystic circle under the plum tree, which provided a canopy of thickening green leaves after its brief blossom time was ended. After the ceremony, Colin always took his walking exercise. After the ceremony, Colin always took his walking exercise, and throughout the day he exercised his newly found power at intervals. Every day he grew stronger and looked good. Each day he grew stronger and could walk more steadily and cover more ground, and each day his belief in the magic grew stronger, as well it might. He tried one experiment after another as he felt himself gaining strength, and it was Dickon who showed him the best things of all. Yesterday, he said one morning after an absence, I went to Thwaite for mother, and near the Blue Cow Inn I see Bob Howarth. He's the strongest chap on the moor. He's the champion wrestler, and he can jump higher than any other chap and throw the hammer farther. He's gone all the way to Scotland for the sports some years. He's knowed me ever since I was a little un, and he's a friendly sort, and I asked him some questions. The gentry calls him an athlete, and I thought of thee, Mr. Colin, and I says, how did thou make thy muscles stick out that way, Bob? Did thou do anything extra to make thyself so strong? And he says, well, yes, lad, I did. A strong man in a show came to Thwaite once and showed me how to exercise my arms and legs and every muscle in my body. And I says, could a delicate chap make himself stronger with him, Bob? And he laughed and says, art thou the delicate chap? And I says, no, but I knows a young gentleman that's getting well of a long illness, and I wish I knowed some of them tricks to tell him about. I didn't say no names, and he didn't ask none. He's friendly, same as I said, and he stood up and showed me good-natured like, and I imitated what he did till I knowed it by heart. Colin had been listening excitedly. Can you show me, he cried, will you? Aye, to be sure, Dickon answered, getting up. But he says thou mun do him gentle at first, and be careful not to tire thysel. Rest in between times, and take deep breaths, and don't overdo. I'll be careful, said Colin. Show me, Dickon, you are the most magic boy in the world. Dickon stood up on the grass and slowly went through a carefully practical but simple series of muscle exercises. Colin watched them with widening eyes. He could do a few while he was sitting down. Presently, he did a few gently while he stood upon his already steadied feet. Mary began to do them also. Soot, who was watching the performance, became much disturbed and left his branch and hopped about restlessly because he could not do them too. From that time, the exercises were part of the day's duties as much as the magic was. It became possible for both Colin and Mary to do more of them each time they tried, and such appetites were the results that but for the basket Dickon put behind the bush each morning when he arrived, they would have been lost. But the little oven in the hollow and Mrs. Sowerby's bounties were so satisfying that Mrs. Medlock and the nurse and Dr. Craven became mystified again. You can trifle with your breakfast and seem to disdain your dinner if you are full to the brim with roasted eggs and potatoes and richly frothed new milk and oat cakes and buns and heather honey and You can trifle with your breakfast and seem to disdain your dinner if you are full to the brim with roasted eggs and potatoes and richly frothed new milk and oat cakes and buns and heather honey and clotted cream. They're eating next to nothing, said the nurse. They'll die of starvation if they can't be persuaded to take some nourishment, and yet see how they look. Look, exclaimed Mrs. Medlock indignantly. Eh, I'm moithered to death with them. They're a pair of young Satans, bursting their jackets one day and the next turning up their noses at the best meals cook can tempt them with. Not a mouthful of that lovely young fowl and bread sauce did they set a fork into yesterday, and the poor woman fair invented a pudding for them. And back it sent. She almost cried. She's afraid she'll be blamed if they starve themselves into their graves. Dr. Craven came and looked at Colin long and carefully. He wore an extremely worried expression when the nurse talked with him and showed him the almost untouched tray of breakfast she had saved for him to look at. But it was even more worried. But it was even more worried when he sat down by Colin's sofa and examined him. He had been called to London on business and had not seen the boy for nearly 2 weeks. When the young things began to gain health, they gained it rapidly. The waxen tinge had left Colin's skin, and a warm rose showed through it. His beautiful eyes were clear, and the hollows under them and in his cheeks and temples had filled out. His once dark, heavy locks had begun to look as if they sprang healthily from his forehead and were soft and warm with life. His lips were fuller and of a normal color. In fact, as an imitation of a boy who was confirmed invalid, he was a disgraceful sight. Dr. Craven held his chin in his hand and thought him over. I am sorry to hear that you do not eat anything, he said. That will not do. You will lose all you have gained. And you have gained amazingly. You ate so well a short time ago. I told you it was an unnatural appetite, answered Colin. Mary was sitting on her stool nearby and suddenly made a very queer sound, which she tried so violently to repress that she ended by almost choking. What is the matter? Said Dr. Craven, turning to look at her. Mary became quite severe in her manner. It was something between a sneeze and a cough, she replied with reproachful dignity, and it got into my throat. But, she said afterward to Colin, I couldn't help myself. It just burst out because all at once I couldn't help remembering that last big potato you ate and the way your mouth stretched when you bit through that thick, lovely crust jam and clotted cream on it. Is there any way in which those children can get food secretly? Dr. Craven inquired of Mrs. Medlock. There's no way unless they dig it out of the earth or pick it up off the trees, Mrs. Medlock answered. They stay out on the grounds all day and see no one but each other. And if they want anything different to eat from what's sent up to them, they need only ask for it. Well, said Dr. Craven, so long as going without food agrees with them, we need not disturb ourselves. The boy is a new creature. So is the girl, said Mrs. Medlock. She's begun to be downright pretty since she's filled out and must. She's begun to be downright pretty since she's filled out and lost her ugly little sour look. Her hair's grown thick and healthy looking, and she's got a bright color. The glummest, ill-natured little thing she used to be, and now her and Master Colin laugh together like a pair of crazy young ones. Perhaps they're growing fat on that. Perhaps they are, said Dr. Craven. Let them laugh. Chapter 25. The Curtain. And the secret garden bloomed and bloomed, and every morning revealed new miracles. In the robin's nest there were eggs, and the robin's mate sat upon them, keeping them warm with her feathery little breast and careful wings. At first she was very nervous, and the robin himself was indignantly watchful. Even Dickon did not go near the close-grown corner in those days, but waited until, by the quiet working of some mysterious spell, he seemed to have conveyed to the soul of the little pair that in the garden there was nothing which was quite like themselves. Nothing. Even Dickon did not go near the close-grown corner in those days, but waited until, by the quiet working of some mysterious spell, he seemed to have conveyed to the soul of the little pair that in the garden there was nothing which was not quite like themselves, nothing which did not understand the wonderfulness of what was happening to them, the immense, tender, terrible, heartbreaking beauty and solemnity of the eggs. If there had been one person in that garden who had not known through all his or her innermost being that if an egg were taken away or hurt, the whole world would whirl round and crash through space and come to an end, if there had been even one who did not feel it and act accordingly, there could have been no happiness even in that golden springtime air. But they all knew it and felt it, and the robin and his mate knew they knew it. At first the robin watched Mary and Colin with sharp anxiety. For some mysterious reason, he knew he need not watch Dickon. The first moment he set his dew bright black eye on Dickon, he knew he was not a stranger, but a sort of a robin without a beak or feathers. He could speak robin, which is a quite distinct language not to be mistaken for any other. To speak robin to a robin is like speaking French to a Frenchman. Dickon always spoke it to the robin himself, so the queer gibberish he used when he spoke to humans did not matter in the least. The robin thought he spoke this gibberish to them because they were not intelligent enough to understand feathered speech. His movements also were robin. They never startled one by being sudden enough to seem dangerous or threatening. Any robin could understand Dickon, so his presence was not even disturbing. But at the outset, it seemed necessary to be on guard against the other two. In the first place, the boy creature did not come into the garden on his own legs. He was pushed in on a thing with wheels, and the skins of wild animals were thrown over him. That in itself was doubtful. Then, when he began to stand up and move about, he did it in a queer, unaccustomed way, and the others seemed to have to help him. The robin used to secret himself in a bush and watch this anxiously, his head tilted first on one side and then on the other. He thought that the slow movements might mean that he was preparing to pounce, as cats do. When cats are preparing to pounce, they creep over the ground very slowly. The robin talked this over with his mate a great deal for a few days, but after that he decided not to speak of the subject because her terror was so great that he was afraid it might be injurious to the eggs. When the boy began to walk by himself and even to move more quickly, it was an immense relief. But for a long time, or it seemed a long time to the robin, he was a source of great anxiety. He did not act as the other humans did. He seemed very fond of walking, but he had a way of sitting or lying down for a while, and then getting up in a disconcerting manner to begin again. One day, the robin remembered that when he himself had been made to learn to fly by his parents, he had done much the same sort of thing. He had taken short flights of a few yards and then had been obliged to rest. So it occurred to him that this boy was learning to fly, or rather to walk. He mentioned this to his mate, and when he told her that the eggs would probably conduct themselves in the same way after they were fledged, she was quite comforted and even became eagerly interested and derived great pleasure from watching the boy over the edge of her nest, though she always thought that the eggs would be much cleverer and learn more quickly. But then she said indulgently that humans were always more clumsy and slow than eggs, and most of them never really seemed to learn to fly at all. You never met them in the air or on treetops. After a while, the boy began to move about as the others did, but all three of the children at times did unusual things. They would stand under the trees and move their arms and legs and heads about in a way which was neither walking nor running nor sitting down. They went through these movements at intervals every day, and the robin was never able to explain to his mate what they were doing or trying to do. He could only say that he was sure the eggs would never flap about in such a manner. But as the boy who could speak robin so fluently was doing the things with them, birds could be quite sure that the actions were not of dangerous nature. Of course, neither the robin nor his mate had ever heard of the champion wrestler Bob Haworth and his exercises for making muscles stand out like lumps. Robins are not like human beings. Their muscles are always exercised from the first, and so they develop themselves in a natural manner. If you have to fly about to find every meal you eat, your muscles do not become atrophied. Atrophied means wasted away through want of use. When the boy was walking and running about and digging and weeding like the others, the nest in the corner was brooded over by a great peace and content. Fears for the eggs became things of the past. Knowing that your eggs were as safe as if they were locked in a bank vault, and the fact that you could watch so many curious things going on made setting a most entertaining occupation. On wet days, the egg's mother sometimes felt even a little dull because the children did not come into the garden. But even on wet days, it could not be said that Mary and Colin were dull. One morning, when the rain streamed down unceasingly, and Colin was beginning to feel a little restive, as he was obliged to remain on his sofa because it was not safe to get up and walk about, Mary had an inspiration. "Now that I am a real boy," Colin had said, "my legs and arms and all my body are so full of magic that I can't keep them still. They want to be doing things all the time. Do you know that when I waken in the morning, Mary, when it's quite early and the birds are just shouting outside and everything seems just shouting for joy, even the trees and things we can't really hear, I feel as if I must jump out of bed and shout myself. If I did it, just think what would happen." Mary giggled inordinately. The nurse would come running, and Mrs. Medlock would come running, and they would be sure you had gone crazy, and they'd send for the doctor, she said. Colin giggled himself. He could see how they would all look, how horrified by his outbreak, and how amazed to see him standing upright. "I wish my father would come home," he said. "I want to tell him myself. I'm always thinking about it. But we couldn't go on like this much longer. I can't stand lying still and pretending, and besides, I look too differently. I wish it wasn't raining today." It was then Mistress Mary had her inspiration. "Colin," she began mysteriously, "do you know how many rooms there are in this house?" "About 1,000, I suppose," he answered. "There's about 100 no one ever goes into," said Mary. "And one rainy day, I went and looked into ever so many of them. No one ever knew, though Mrs. Medlock nearly found me out. I lost my way when I was coming back, and I stopped at the end of your corridor. That was the second time I heard you crying." Colin sat up on his sofa. 100 rooms no one goes into, he said. It sounds almost like a secret garden. Suppose we go and look at them. You could wheel me in my chair, and nobody would know where we went.
That's what I was thinking, said Mary. No one would dare follow us. There are galleries where you could run. We could do our exercises. There's a little Indian room where there's a cabinet full of ivory elephants. There are all sorts of rooms.
Ring the bell, said Colin. When the nurse came in, he gave his orders. I want my chair, he said. Mistress Mary and I are going to look at the part of the house which is not used. John can push me as far as the picture gallery, because there are some stairs. Then he must go away and leave us alone until I send for him again.
Rainy days lost their terrors that morning. When the footman had wheeled the chair into the picture gallery and left the two together in obedience to orders, Colin and Mary looked at each other, delighted. As soon as Mary made sure that John was really on his way back to his own quarters below the stairs, Colin got out of his chair. I am going to run from one end of the gallery to the other, he said, and then I am going to jump, and then we will do Bob Hayward's exercises. And they did all these things and many others. They looked at the portraits and found the plain little girl dressed in green brocade and holding the parrot on her finger. All these, said Colin, must be my relations. They lived a long time ago. The parrot one, I believe, is one of my great-great-great-great-aunts. She looks rather like you, Mary. Not as you look now, but as you looked when you came here. Now you are a great deal fatter and better looking. So are you, said Mary, and they both laughed. They went to the Indian room and amused themselves with the ivory elephants. They found the rose-colored brocade boudoir and the hole in the cushion the mouse had left, but the mice had grown up and run away, and the hole was empty. They saw more rooms and made more discoveries than Mary had made on her first pilgrimage. They found new corridors and corners and flights of steps and new old pictures they liked and weird old things they did not know the use of. It was a curiously entertaining morning, and the feeling of wandering about in the same house with other people, but at the same time feeling as if one were miles away from them, was a fascinating thing.
I'm glad we came, said Colin. I never knew I lived in such a big, queer old place. I like it. We will ramble about every rainy day. We shall always be finding new queer corners and things. That morning, they had found, among other things, such good appetites that when they returned to Colin's room, it was not possible to send the luncheon away untouched. When the nurse carried the tray downstairs, she slapped it down on the kitchen dresser so that Mrs. Loomis, the cook, could see the highly polished dishes and plates. Look at that, she said. This house is a house of mystery, and those two children are the greatest mysteries in it. If they keep that up every day, said the strong young footman, John, there'd be a small wonder that he weighs twice as much today as he did a month ago. I should have to give up my place in time for fear of doing my muscles an injury. That afternoon, Mary noticed that something new had happened in Colin's room. She noticed it the day before, but had said nothing because she thought the change might have been made by chance. She said nothing today, but she sat and looked fixedly at the picture over the mantel. She could look at it because the curtain had been drawn aside. That was the change she noticed. I know what you want me to tell you, said Colin, after she had stared a few minutes. I always know when you want me to tell you something. You are wondering why the curtain is drawn back. I am going to keep it like that.
Why? Asked Mary.
Because it doesn't make me angry anymore to see her laughing. I wakened when it was bright moonlight 2 nights ago and felt as if the magic was filling the room and making everything so splendid that I couldn't lie still. I got up and looked out of the window. The room was quite light, and there was a patch of moonlight on the curtain, and somehow that made me go and pull the cord. She looked right down at me, as if she were laughing because she was glad I was standing there. It made me like to look at her. I want to see her laughing, like that all the time. I think she must have been a sort of magic person, perhaps.
You are so like her now, said Mary, that sometimes I think perhaps you are her ghost made into a boy. The idea seemed to impress Colin. He thought it over and then answered her slowly. If I were her ghost, my father would be fond of me, he said. Do you want him to be fond of you? Inquired Mary. I used to hate it because he was not fond of me. If he grew fond of me, I think I should tell him about the magic. It might make him more cheerful. Thank you for joining me for another relaxing literature podcast. If you are enjoying this podcast, please consider supporting to help me improve the quality. And please follow me on Instagram at Relaxing Literature to leave your comments or suggestions on what you would like to have me read next. Good night.